In this episode, Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert talks about the tax debates and how the Republican tax plan will affect Wisconsin. We look at allegations against City Treasurer Spencer Coggs and State Rep Josh Zepnik, as well as other sexual harassment updates. And James Causey discusses a controversial social media posting about gun-toting contractors in the city. All that, plus winners and losers and viewer questions, today on JS on Politics. Welcome to JS on Politics. I'm your host, Mary Spacuzza. I spoke earlier with Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert about the big fight over the tax debate in D.C. Here's what he had to say. I'm joined now by Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Great to be with you.
There's been a lot of talk this week about the tax bill. Obviously, the House passed their version, the Senate passed their version, but they're different bills. So where do we go from here?
Yeah, there's a little bit of drama left in this issue. I think everybody expects there to be a Republican tax cut enacted, passed by Congress and signed by the president, probably before the end of the year. But right now, there are differences between these two bills that have to be negotiated. There are negotiations taking place basically between House Republicans and Senate Republicans. And, you know, there's some math issues they have to work out. They're trying to, there's a small minority of taxpayers in this bill that would actually pay more. It's under 10% in the short run. And so Republicans are trying to reduce that number. And in order to reduce that number, they have to basically probably reduce the impact slightly of the corporate tax cut. Those are some of the trade-offs that are being considered right now.
What does this mean for some of our high-profile Wisconsin lawmakers, obviously House Speaker Paul Ryan, but also U.S. Senator from Wisconsin, Ron Johnson?
Yeah, Ron Johnson kind of played a big role at the end of this debate. He had a very particular concern that had to do with a class of businesses where the owners collect their pay their taxes as income as opposed to sort of corporate taxes, and cutting taxes for corporations, his concern created an unequal playing field with these other businesses who weren't getting the same kind of tax benefits. That was one of the things that's making this bill more expensive. That issue still has to be worked out. None of the Wisconsin lawmakers are on the conference, except for obviously Paul Ryan, the House Speaker, the negotiating team, but he's been promised sort of a voice on this one particular issue. So we'll see how that plays out. For Paul Ryan, it's obviously going to be the signature achievement, legislative achievement of the first year of the Trump presidency. And we'll have to see how that plays out politically for him.
I had seen reports that some taxpayers who would be paying more were those who were making, you know, less than $70,000 a year. How would this affect Wisconsin voters?
Well, one estimate is that in Wisconsin, about 6% of the taxpayers would be paying more in the short run. Now, in the long run, that number could grow because a lot of the tax cuts in one version of this legislation are temporary. They have to lapse after 10 years just to make the math in the bill work out so it doesn't add to the deficit after 10 years. The politics are really interesting. I mean, one thing I'll say about in traveling around the state, my sense is that I'll be doing more of this next week. A lot of people don't know what's in the tax bill. I mean, tax cuts and taxes have not been a front burner issue the way healthcare has been. So it makes the politics a little unpredictable. I mean, it may be that it may reduce the political benefit Republicans get immediately out of this tax cut because it's not necessarily as salient an issue as some others, but it may also make it harder for Democrats to mobilize against the tax cut. These things, it's going to be one sort of very unpredictable factor, X factor, in the next midterm election cycle here in Wisconsin and also in other states.
Okay. Well, Craig Gilbert, thank you so much, and we'll look forward to seeing you back in Wisconsin soon.
All right.
Thanks. I'm joined now by Jason Stein in Madison and columnist Daniel Bice here in the Milwaukee office. Thanks, guys. So we've got a bunch of actually breaking news and some sexual harassment revelations that we've been covering. Jason, I'm going to go to you first. In recent days, you've covered City Treasurer Spencer Coggs. You've covered Josh Zepnik. What is the latest on those?
Well, we've seen calls for Representative Josh Zepnik to resign his post after it was reported that he without warning, while he was intoxicated, kissed a couple women at Democratic events. He has said that he has stopped drinking and changed his life in that respect. He also got a drunken driving citation about 2 years ago. But he has resisted calls for him to resign. And then in the case of former state senator, now Milwaukee City Treasurer Spencer Coggs, the state paid out about $74,000 to settle a sexual harassment claim against the treasurer. And that claim, in that case, an administrative law judge did find probable cause that he had harassed a former employee.
Okay.
So we see two different responses here. We get Spencer Coggs, who's denying he did anything wrong, and that saying that this isn't a problem, has no plans to resign. He was a state senator at the time.
Long-time state senator.
Yeah, but now is the treasurer a big bump up in pay for him back, you know, from going $50,000 as state senator to $114,000 as state treasurer, whereas Josh Zepnik is saying, I had a drinking problem, and it's unusual to use that as your defense, and to say I was drunk at the time, but I've fixed that problem, so everything's solved and things are okay. I mean, it's a little bit unusual. You're still responsible for what you do when you're drunk. As you know, if you're driving and drunk, you have to, there are consequences for that. But apparently, harassing others while drunk, he thinks is not an offense.
Right. It's been an interesting difference in response, too, where we've had numerous people calling on Representative Zepnik to step down, removing him from committee posts. But there's really been very little criticism about Spencer Coggs. Mayor Barrett told me he needed to review the facts of the case. There's been one state rep from Fitchburg said that he really should step down, but other than that, not much. So,
well, I mean, there's a big difference between the two as well. The Coggs is from a politically established family. The Coggses have held seats in the legislature for a long time and been very influential in politics here. Plus, we wrote some stories about this situation back in 2012. We didn't write how they were resolved, so this isn't completely new, whereas with Josh Zepnik, these are new revelations.
Okay. And we also had some news this week about the John Doe, or an investigation into the John Doe, I should say. Jason, what's the latest with that?
Sure. Well, we had a report, a 90-page report yesterday from the Department of Justice, in which essentially the department said that it criticized the John Doe investigation into Governor Scott Walker's campaign for being overly broad and not doing enough to protect sensitive evidence that was seized, and recommended contempt of court charges against a number of people associated with the investigation.
Okay.
The investigation ends up targeting a now defunct agency, the Government Accountability Board, which had been collecting a lot of the information. The John Doe's investigations were started by the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office, but the Government Accountability Board, which used to oversee ethics and elections.
Right. It's been disbanded, split in half.
They gathered a lot of information, and obviously some of that information got leaked to The Guardian. And there was other information that was leaked to The Wall Street Journal, but the Department of Justice didn't look at that half. They only looked at the revelations, which were critical of Scott Walker, that appeared in The Guardian.
Right, not the Wall Street Journal leaks, which were positive towards
Republicans and conservatives. So, but there are some revelations. One, we find out a list of 35 people whose emails and other personal information had been gathered as a result of the John Doe investigation. Brad Schimmel, the Attorney General, refers to a third John Doe that went on. It wasn't a formal John Doe, but a third issue he was interested in. But in the end, as I said, it targets a defunct agency, and most of the criticisms directed at a former attorney there, Shane Falk, who no longer works in the government. So just like John Doe 2, this one ends up with no criminal convictions or charges against anybody.
And really, it doesn't sound like it's clear who the leaker was. I mean,
you know that Brad Schimmel thinks it was someone at the Government Accountability Board. In fact, it goes to the point to say that no one from we know it didn't come from the Wisconsin Supreme Court or the courts, and we know it didn't come from the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office, and it had to have come from somebody with or associated with the Government Accountability Board, and most likely Shane Fogg.
Okay. We also have some new breaking news today. It's hard to keep up, but we have a new woman in the governor's race.
Former state rep. Well, it's hard to keep up with this. You know, I was just looking at how many people have filed an interest or intent of running the governor's race, and we have 16 people. About eight of them, I guess you would call major or quasi-major candidates, but Representative Kelly Helen Royce, you covered her.
Representative Royce, right?
When she was a state legislator. This morning, she posted on a private Facebook page that she was hiring because she had decided to run for governor, sort of an odd way to announce that you're running. And in fact, it's not a formal announcement, but...
Because this was like a private Facebook group that...
Right. It was supposed to be women only who were people interested in doing campaign work. But of course, that sort of stuff gets out. And so she's in, and you know, she'll be an interesting... The Republicans are already attacking her, but she'll be an interesting candidate. She's young.
Under 40.
She's got business experience, and she... has a record. She was in the legislature for 4 years. So sort of a different personnel, a different profile than any of the other candidates in the race right now, I think.
Right. And Jason and I covered her in the legislature when she was a state rep, obviously a outspoken critic of Governor Scott Walker, especially with his Act 10 union plans. She was on the floor trying to block that bill from passing. She then left the legislature after losing to Mark Pocan.
Right. She ran for Congress. She gave up her seat in 2012 to run for Congress and ends up losing to Mark Pocan.
And then has gone on to do Open Homes, a business startup, kind of a tech realty company. So, Jason, any thoughts on Representative Voorhees and what she will add to the race?
Well, the field is starting to get set now. I mean, it's still a possibility that Madison Mayor Paul Soglin will jump into the race. But it's starting to get set, and it is a really big field. So, you know, I think what we can say right now is this primary is going to be really unlike any statewide primary we've seen in a generation for a major office in Wisconsin. And, you know, really it may be possible for one candidate to win with a sliver of the electorate that is much smaller than it would typically take to win a statewide primary like this, just because it's so fragmented, the field.
So we have, as I said, like eight major, quasi-major candidates. It would be amazing if all eight make it to the primary next year. I mean, that's what's going to happen between now and then. You're going to have some infighting, I assume some debates, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, how these candidates stand up over the next 10 months or so. But yeah, you've got candidates from Milwaukee, you've got candidates from Madison now, you've got out-state candidates,
right.
You've got female candidates, male candidates, you've got people with government experience, you've got people with private sector experience. It's quite a field. The only race that I can remember there was anything like this was the 2004 Milwaukee mayoral race, which had 10 or 11 candidates. Eventually, I think 9 made it there, and Tom Barrett, Marvin Pratt, and David Clark were the 3 main candidates for there. But there was a pretty humorous ad run during that time where they had an ad like the Brady Bunch with all 9 of the major candidates appearing in the ad. But yeah, this will be completely different than anything that we've seen before in a statewide race.
Okay, well, Jason, stick around, please. And Bice, we're going to take a break and go back to an interview I had earlier today with columnist James Causey about a controversial social media posting involving subcontractors in the city who were carrying guns on the work site. Here's what he had to say. I'm joined now by columnist James Causey with the Journal Sentinel. And James, you covered a story this week involving a shocking photo circulating on social media involving city contractors. Can you tell us about what that whole story was?
Yeah, this was a Facebook-driven type of story. It involved three subcontractors from Hartford, from American Sewer Services. They were seen in a photo where one guy had a gun out showing it to 2 other workers who had belts, their guns in holsters. And when people saw this photo, it was from on 19th and Monarchy, it just took off on Facebook. and people wanted to know why these were white contractors in a predominantly black neighborhood. And this was within a block of Phyllis Wheatley Elementary School. And it set the city on fire, literally.
And what did the Common Council do about it? I know they talked about it at a meeting recently.
Right. So the photo was actually taken November 30th, and Alderman Malele Cog saw the photo, and she jumped on it right away. And what they decided to do was get to the bottom of it, because the workers, at first, they had on Poblaki uniforms. And so a lot of people thought it was Poblaki, which is a major contractor here.
Poblaki Paving.
That it was. But it turned out it was American Sewer Services. So they had to get to the bottom of that. Once they did that, they had a meeting yesterday, and they decided to fix it, write a resolution so that subcontractors wouldn't carry guns. One worker who had the gun out, he was fired. The two other guys were placed on suspension. And the person who took the photo, nothing happened to him. And so they're still trying to figure out what to do with something like this. Mm-hmm. The shocking thing that happened yesterday was when Alderman Bob Donovan talked, and he said, well, you know, I know it states in our laws that, you know, city workers can't carry guns, but I know for a fact that some city workers do carry guns to work every day. And that was like, whoa, what happened there? Alderman Nick Kovac said, well, how do you know? And Alderman Donovan said, because they told me. So it's a lot of stuff going on here. But bottom line, guns should not be carried by city workers.
Okay. So, well, thank you so much. And, that was definitely a disturbing image. And kind of, do they carry those when they're working elsewhere, just in Milwaukee, I think was the question.
So what's going to happen now is they're going to have this resolution, come up with a plan to make sure that this doesn't happen again. But we'll have to wait and see what happens with that.
Okay. Well, James Causey, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Thanks. We're back for everybody's favorite, winners and losers. Jason, we're going to go to you first. Who's your winner?
Well, my winner is out of the Senate tax bill that passed last week. Corporate shareholders. So if you make income from owning companies, this is going to be a good bill for you. Republicans are going to also claim that by spurring the economy, it's going to be good for other people. But, you know, what we know for sure is that, you know, company owners are going to see significantly lower taxes going forward.
I might jump in here. I'm going to be posting a story today. It's audio of Senator Johnson yesterday, who voted for the Senate tax bill,
right,
criticizing the bill, saying it's unjust to small and medium-sized businesses. So even though he voted for the bill, he still has major problems and objections to it.
Okay, and he had tried to fix that.
And they did some tweaking.
Okay.
But in his speech to this group of, it was African-American owners of small and medium-sized businesses, he says 86% of the tax benefit will go to C-corps, large corporations, and that businesses like theirs will only get 14% of the benefit. And he's telling them, please start lobbying them. Otherwise, this will be an unjust bill.
Got it. Okay. Jason, what about your loser?
Well, my loser is out of the same bill, and that is realtors, because there's a couple of changes in the bill. One, it limits the amount of property taxes that a homeowner could deduct. That's going to mostly affect wealthy homeowners who have very large homes. But at the same time, by increasing the size of the standard deduction as well, what the impact of that bill, I think, is going to be is providing a little less financial incentive for people to own homes as opposed to rent. And that's one of the reasons why you've seen the realtors be one of the most critical business groups against the bill over the last couple months.
Okay. All right. What about your loser?
My loser is Paul Nealon, who's a Republican running against Paul Ryan.
Clearly running from the right, we could say.
Yeah, yes. He is. And he ran last time and lost. And no one expects him to win this time, but he had a pretty extreme tweet this morning, since we're all now covering Twitter full time.
Right.
There's a New York Post columnist, John Poteritz, who had written he'd done his own tweet saying someone he disagreed with should probably go eat something because their brain wasn't functioning very well. Paul Nealon responded by saying, maybe you need to go eat a bullet.
Wow.
He's now since followed up to say he actually met a Boston bullet, which is a snack food. But Obviously, I think most people would not advise you to send the first note.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And Neilan tries to be out there, but this is, I mean, most people, you know, that's just not something you say.
No. Not if you want to run for public office, and generally just not at all.
Right.
Right.
So,
and my
winner.
Yeah, who's your winner?
And my winner is Tammy Baldwin. The Washington is very focused on Al Franken and his decision to resign.
Mm-hmm.
For a while it looked like he was going to stay on. Right. But as the number of accusers started to increase, Senator Tammy Baldwin, who's a good friend of Al Franken's, went out there yesterday and called on him to resign, which is a tough thing to do with a friend. But, you know, you score political points because it was the right thing to do. I think everybody pretty much agrees at this point that it would be very hard for him to continue in office with all of these allegations against him.
Okay. All right. We've got a bunch of viewer questions. We're not going to be able to get to all of them, but we'll see what we can do. All right, one comes from the John Doe, and why don't you take this one? John Casper asks, who was the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter that the John Doe defendants sent 31 emails about?
We don't know. It
doesn't. We're going to guess?
Well, for some reason.
Jason, can you guess it was Bice?
Yes. Okay. I think it's a good chance that you are seated at the table.
It's one of us.
Well, Jason here. Jason,
but we don't know. But
Jason
don't
and
know.
Patrick and I have written a lot about John Doe 2, but mm-hmm. I wrote a lot about John Doe 1. And for some reason became very associated with it. And I've been told mm-hmm. by someone very close to John Doe that some emails involving me got caught up in the discussion, and they were telling me to be careful with what I was saying on emails. So that happened in 2014. So obviously something was stirring then. And so I'll agree with you too. Probably it was about me.
Okay. Jason, why don't you take this one from Laura, which says, it begins, where is the court of law when it comes to politicians being accused of something? Essentially, I'm guessing this is a question about probably due process, but do you want to talk about that, about politicians being accused of things like sexual harassment and sexual assault, Stein?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think this is coming up with, you know, local politicians all the way up to figures like Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore and Minnesota U.S. Senator Al Franken, that you have allegations of sexual misconduct being made about these folks. And you see an argument in the public domain about, you know, are these allegations proven? You hear some people talk about it being important for them to have due process. I mean, it's noting that none of these political figures so far have been taken into court. I mean, it's very important that we in the media get our reporting on these allegations accurate, but the court that political figures are in is not a legal court, it's the court of public opinion. Mm-hmm. And there's a different standard for whether or not you want to elect someone to the most exclusive club in the world or keep them in the most exclusive club in the world, like the U.S. Senate. And the standard that you would use to send someone to prison. And sometimes you do see a confusion, I think, on the part of the public, or maybe a willful attempt on the part of politicians to confuse the public about what those standards ought to be.
I think there's also a difference as to who the accuser is. If it's an employee making an allegation against an employer, such as we had with Spencer Coggs, mm-hmm. you can file with the state, the Equal Rights Division, and say that you've been discriminated against or harassed, or you can file with the federal EEOC. You have a couple of those, but if it's something that rises to the level of a rape, then you could have criminal prosecutions as you are having, or investigations as you're having with the Weinstein case. But with some of these, where with Al Franken, it was someone standing next to him for a picture. You're not an employee. That obviously isn't a rape or a sexual assault. That becomes something that is just going to be debated publicly.
But then once a number, I think when, you know, accuser after accuser comes forward, it really starts to raise questions about, you know, if it was just one person versus now how many have come out against Del Franco.
Or how specific they are with, mm-hmm. with John Conyers. There were several people there, but just how specific and graphic some of those things were mm-hmm. made it impossible for him to continue in office.
Right, and there is a different standard between being convicted in a court of law and losing the trust of voters.
You know what else affects this is how the accused person responds. If someone like Donald Trump, who just denies, and says there's no truth to this, the consequences have been different from him as opposed to someone like Al Franken, who's not, he said maybe some of the specifics are not exactly right, but he's not really disputed these things. And, you know, the response publicly has been very different. You know, and we saw that here locally with Spencer Coggs denying that nothing inappropriate happened between him and his former employee, and Josh Zubnick, who's not denying it, mm-hmm. But just saying that he was incapacitated, so it shouldn't count against him.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, but
it's worth.
Sorry,
it's
go
worth
ahead,
noting. I was just going to say it was worth noting in the case of Senator Coggs, then Senator Coggs, that there was an administrative law judge that did a very extensive examination of the allegations and came to a conclusion that there was probable cause to believe that his employee had been sexually harassed and discriminated against.
Which is what happens if you file with the Employment Rights Division or the EEOC.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Those things,
right.
Someone will go through and review that. And there was even someone thinking about running for governor who had a case who went through the ERD and just because of the possibility of some coverage of that, decided not to run for office. So, sure, you do not want to have Mayor John Norquist had a case with
right.
Marilyn Figueroa, former staffer. She filed with the EERD, also the EEOC. ERD found probable cause, and the city decided to cut its losses and to pay her almost $400,000. So, there is some decision as to whether it's credible or not in those cases.
And we'll have to see with President Trump's denials, because now he's heading into court with a sexual harassment case dating back from his time at the, or someone he had worked with during The Apprentice and essentially been her boss. And then there's also, I don't know if you'd seen the Billy Bush editorial of Trump had gone as far as questioning and denying whether it was his voice on the Access
right.
Hollywood tape, and Billy Bush made it pretty clear that that was indeed his voice saying those things. So that is all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, and we will be back next week for JS on Politics.